Our Bible reading is taken from Luke chapter 8, Luke chapter 8, and we're reading from verse 26, and Alex is going to come and read that to us, so Luke chapter 8 and verse 26.
They sailed to the region of the Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the impure spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot, it kept under guard. He had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him. And they begged Jesus repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into the pigs, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported this in the town and countryside. And the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out, sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them, because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return home and tell how much God has done for you." So the man went away and told all over the town how much Jesus had done for him. Amen.
Thanks very much, Alec. Well, this evening we're continuing our studies in the Gospel of Luke, and you'll remember in our last study, Jesus calmed the raging sea. This evening, he calms a raging man. He demonstrates that he has authority not only over the natural world, but over the spiritual world as well. I want you to notice four things. First of all, the evil confronted. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was confronted, verse 27 tells us, by a man who had demons. A man who had demons. Now, I want you to notice a number of things. First of all, notice the symptoms of his condition. In verse 27, we have this vivid description of this man. We're told that he was naked, not the usual condition for a person in conservative culture in the Middle East. But this man was shameless. It seems that he wasn't aware of his embarrassing condition. Secondly, we're told that he didn't live in a house, but he lived among the tombs. Now, to the Jews, that was unthinkable to touch a corpse or to come in contact with a grave or a tomb would render the individual unclean. Such a person wouldn't be allowed to enter the community, worship in the synagogue, or offer sacrifices at the temple. He was excluded because of his defilement. Notice in verse 29, we're told he was driven into the desert, into a place of isolation, on the fringe of society, and on the verge of insanity. We're told by Mark that at night he would cut himself with stones, and he would cry out continually. Self-mutilation is an indication of a breakdown in mental health, and it's interesting that after he was confronted with Jesus, in verse 35, we're told that he was in his right mind. So you can imagine the scene. This man wandering in the graveyard among the tombs, cutting himself, crying out with this eerie scream. It's not the kind of place you would let the children play, nor would it be the place that you would take your Sunday or your Saturday afternoon stroll. People avoided this man like the plague, the symptoms of the condition. Secondly, notice the reason for the condition. We're told that this man was possessed by a demon in verse 27. When Jesus had stepped out on the land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. This man was under the control and influence of evil spirits. Now, it seems to me that when people come across this phenomena in the New Testament, they make one of two mistakes. Either they say that since the symptoms of demon possession, as given in the New Testament, are similar to the symptoms associated either with mental illness or epilepsy, that the writers of the New Testament, in their ignorance, and remember, Luke was a doctor, they put this down to demon possession, but it was that they were simply insane, that they were unwell. The other danger is that people accept demon possession as it stands, and they conclude that the phenomena is all around us today, and they become obsessed with demonology, and they see demons in everyone and everything. Let me just say one or two things about that. I do believe that what we have in the New Testament is demon possession and not mental illness or epilepsy. And I also don't believe that we see demon possession in the same form and to the same degree as it was in the New Testament. You must remember that the devil was at the height of his activity. He unleashed a flurry of opposition to confront the Son of God as he came into the world. Added to that, you must remember that when Jesus died, something momentous and powerful happened to Satan. Jesus said in John 12 and verse 34, "The prince of this world will be driven out when I am lifted up from the earth." He spoke in Matthew 12, 29 of the strong man being bound. And so there was heightened devilish activity to meet and undermine the ministry of Jesus when he came into the world. And so for that reason, I think we don't see what we have described in the New Testament to the same extent and to the same degree today. Does happen, I'm sure, but not in the same way, nor to the same strength. I think that's important to notice. So the symptoms of the condition, the reason for the condition, and then the response to the condition. I want you to notice in verse 29, we're told, "For many a time it had seized him, and he was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demons into the desert." Now, I have a question for you. If this man was strong enough to break the chains, how did people chain him or get to chain him in the first place? If he was this wild character, cutting himself with stones and almost endued with a superhuman strength, how did they get to put the shackles on him in the first place? Well, Mark tells us in his account that no one was strong enough to bind him. Indeed, Mark says he even broke the leg irons that he had been put in. So how did people bind him? How did they get to him to bind him? And the answer lies in the nature of demon possession. It seems that demon possession wasn't a continual condition, but a person would have periods of relative normality. Then suddenly and violently, the demons would seize the individual and they would be driven into this frightening and self-destroying frenzy. So he was obviously bound in chains during those periods of normality. We know that from sources outside the Bible, that the binding of someone with chains was a common medical procedure with somebody in this kind of condition. It was an attempt to curb the inner violence by outward restraint. And if that was the case, it's maybe that this man himself was actually looking for help and allowed himself to be restrained in this way. So imagine the scene. This man wakes up among the tombs after days of violent rampage. He's disheveled. He's unshaven. His clothes are in tatters. He's lying in his own filth. He smells foul. His hair is matted and unkempt. The broken chains dangle from his wrists and from his ankles. As a Jew, he is disgusted that he's living among the tombs. He remembers better days, days when he was with his family, with his wife and children. He thinks back to days where in the synagogue he would be invited to read the law to the people. He remembers sitting down with his family and maybe holding down a job. And he's full of regret and remorse. And so after washing him and waiting the 7 prescribed days that were necessary after touching a dead body to be admitted back into Jewish society, he goes to his home city. "Help me," he says. "Help me, for God's sake. Help me. Something needs to be done." And so in a desperate attempt to deliver himself, he realized from this terrible condition that something has to be done, and he allows himself to be chained by his friends. He desperately wants deliverance. But then suddenly, the demon comes upon him. He is filled with anger. He breaks the chains of restraint and returns to the life of defilement among the tombs, frightening everyone in the district. All of his attempts ended in failure, and he's driven to despair again and again. Although I said we don't see this kind of phenomena today and to the same extent and to the same degree in our world, this man nevertheless is a picture, an illustration of all those who are held in the grip of sin and Satan. He drives them from society into broken relationships, into isolation. He puts them on the road to self-destruction and shamelessness. You only have to look at a drunk lying in his own vomit in the street, or a prostitute walking the street selling her body to make a few pounds to feed her addiction, or the philandering father long abandoned by his long-suffering wife and children, living alone with no one to love. The promiscuous teenager riddled with venereal disease and dumped by a series of boys who only use her in order to get one thing. And she discovers that her free love has actually destroyed her very capacity to love. That's what Satan does. He drives us to the fringes. He drives us to despair. He drives us to isolation. Sin will take you further than you want to go, and it will keep you longer than you want to stay. That's sin. And this man experienced that in his life. The evil confronted. Secondly, notice the authority exercised. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was confronted with this man. Now, when you read the text and compare the gospel records, you'll discover that it's actually the demon himself who addresses Jesus in verse 28. "I beg you, do not torment me." You see it in verse 30. Jesus then asked, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. You see it in verse 32, where they beg Jesus not to be put into the abyss, but to enter the pigs. So from the text, it seems this conversation actually was carried on and conducted between Jesus and the demons rather than between Jesus and the man. Now notice the demons themselves acknowledge the divinity and authority of Jesus. Verse 28, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" Son of the Most High God. I remember we said before that in Semitic thought, to be a son of wasn't simply describing your relationship or your identity. It was describing that you were of the same stuff, as we were thinking this morning, the same nature as that person. So when you insulted somebody and you called them the son of a pig or the son of a dog, you weren't actually insulting the person's parents. You were insulting them. You were saying that they had the nature of a pig or a dog. And here these demons ascribe to Jesus full deity. that he is the Son of the Most High God, that he possesses the nature of God. These demons have no difficulty acknowledging the divinity of Christ. James tells us that even the demons believe and tremble. They acknowledge his divinity and they acknowledge his authority, his ability. They say at the end of verse 28, I beg you, don't torment me. Look at verses 30 to 31. Jesus asked him, what is your name? And he said, Legion, for many demons had entered him. And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Our Roman legion consisted of 6,000 soldiers as well as 120 horsemen and technical personnel. And so the name legion to a Roman or indeed to a Jew brought an image of great numbers, efficient and powerful strength. The number, I think, isn't meant to be taken literally. It's just this man was possessed by lots and lots of demons. He had a legion of demons. They held sway over him, reducing him to a tragic shell of his former self. They had wrecked this man's life with the authority and control they exercised over him. But in the presence of Jesus, these demons bow to his authority and to his power. He exercises authority and control over them. For years they had controlled the man, but now Jesus controls them. Jesus is sovereign, even over the powers of hell. Jesus, the name, high over all, in hell or earth or sky, angels and men before it fall, and devils fear and fly. He exercises authority even over the demons. And that's why when you meet Christians that have an unhealthy interest in demonology, almost an obsession with demonology, and they see demons in everything and in everyone, you must remember the words of Jesus, or the words of John, sorry, greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world, that Jesus exercises all authority, even over the demonic world. Jesus commands these demons to come out of the man, and they come out. Jesus demonstrates his power and authority over them. That's very important to understand. But there's something else here. In verse 32, the demons beg not to be sent into the abyss, into hell, but they want to enter this large herd of pigs. And immediately Jesus gives permission, and the pigs rush down the steep bank into the lake and are drowned. Now, why would Jesus allow such a thing to happen? Well, I think he's illustrating something. He is, first of all, giving infallible proof that the demons had left the man, because if they'd gone into the pigs, they had come out of him. But secondly, I think it's a demonstration of the power of God in preserving this man's life until he met Jesus. People who study demonology tell us that the great object of demons is to cause the destruction of the flesh, to bring about death. And here is this man, and he's possessed by demons, and it's a tragic situation. He could cut himself with stones. He could live in isolation, but he could not kill himself. But as soon as those demons enter the mindless pigs rush down the steep bank into the water and are drowned. God kept this man alive. God preserved him. The demons were actually restricted in what they could inflict upon this man. Remember those mysterious words of Jesus to Peter? Simon, Simon, Satan has asked. He has asked to sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith may not utterly fail, and when you turn back, strengthen the brothers. Well, here, God is exercising control over these demons in this man's life, preserving him, restraining them until he meets Jesus. You know the story of Pilgrim's Progress, and then Christian leaves the city of destruction, and he comes through the sloughs despond to the narrow door, and he knocks the door and he says, I'm a burdened sinner coming from the city of destruction on my way to the celestial city. Suddenly the door opens and a hand reaches round and grabs him and pulls him in. Christian's a bit startled and he's a bit taken back and he says, why did you grab me? And he says, because there's a castle and the captain of that castle is Beelzebub, and he fires arrows at those that come to the narrow gate that he might kill them before they enter. And I think John Bunyan is referring to experiences in his own life because he had a number of near-death experiences. On one occasion, he was nearly drowned at sea. Another time, he fell out of a boat in the River Ouse that flowed through Bedford and nearly drowned again. He was unable to swim. And on another occasion, he picked up an adder. He hit it with a stick. And he put his hands into the adder's mouth and pulled out the tongue of the adder, the poison of the adder, with his bare hands. Absolutely reckless. And then it was the time of the Civil War in England, and he was sent on a mission, and a soldier to a particular town, and another soldier came to him, and he said, look, could I go in your place? Because my family live in that town that you're to go to. So John Bunyan exchanged places for him. And the substitute was shot through the head on an ambush and died. And I think that's what Bunyan's alluding to when he talks about Beelzebub firing arrows to kill before they enter the gates. I don't know if anybody here has had a near-death experience. An accident that almost happened. Situations that almost developed. Tragedies that were avoided by a whisker. Could it be that God was preserving you and keeping you so that you might enter the narrow gate? So that you might have this encounter with Jesus? So that you might, if you're not a Christian, be at this service tonight and hear about Christ and his delivering power, that he has kept you and spared you to this very moment? It's a marvelous demonstration of the power and authority of Jesus and God. The evil confronted, the authority exercised, the difference made. Look at verses 34 and 35. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. People say, what a difference a day makes. What a difference Jesus makes. Those who owned the pigs ran off and told everybody what had happened. And a large crowd set out full of curiosity to see for themselves. And the scene that confronted them was mind-blowing. They see this once passionate, animal-like man, uncontrollable, sitting, clothed, and in his right mind. What a change. He is now clothed where previously he had been naked. He's now sitting where previously he had been rushing about in this frenzy. He's quiet, listening to Jesus when previously he had been crying out in this uncontrollable way. He's now comfortable in the presence of Jesus. Do you notice that? Rather than asking not to be tormented by Jesus. He's completely changed. This man is now rational, controlled, and sitting at the feet of Jesus, listening to the teaching of Jesus. His spiritually disfigured and distorted life had been radically and permanently changed. The sight must have been astonishing to those who knew him previously. Normally, they were frightened and intimidated in the presence of this uncontrollable man. But now this man is docile. He's like a child sitting in the presence of Jesus. And that's what the gospel does. That's what an encounter with Jesus does. Paul says in 2 Corinthians, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. A new creation. The old is gone and the new has come. His the old life that plagued him and demented him was taken from him. He's a new creation. Stories told of a man preaching in the open air in New York, being heckled by a communist, and the communist points to a tramp and he says, "What could Christianity do for that man? Communism," he says, "would put a new coat on that man." To which the preacher said, "Christianity would put a new man in that coat." The gospel radically changes people. Another time I heard a preacher who was heckled, and he was preaching on Jesus turning the water into wine, and the man shouted, "Water into wine, water into wine. That's just unbelievable. How could Jesus change water into wine?" To which the preacher said, "Well, I know in my life he has changed wine into furniture. He's changed whiskey into shoes for my children. And he has changed beer into a coat for my wife." He changes people. I told you before I was invited to preach in Stapleford at a charismatic church. And never preached at the charismatic church before, but anyway, I was preaching at this charismatic church, and they met me at the airport. This couple met me at the airport with a big sign, "Welcome Pastor Steve," and a big fish on it. But everybody knew what it was, and it was Dave and Polly who met me. And Dave was smoking. He was standing at the thing waiting to welcome me with a cigarette. But they were just full of the joy of the Lord, and they told me their story, that Dave, their son was killed in friendly fire in Canada, and Dave went into a deep period of depression. He was a painter, a very well-known, apparently, artist, but he started to drink secretly, and he was out walking his dog, and he fell over, and he had to be carried home. An ambulance brought him home on three occasions, and increasingly then, the drink got hold of his life, and he had to be brought home on three or four occasions. And then he went to church one night, and he was dramatically and permanently changed. And Polly said to me, "I have a new husband. The old Dave is gone." And that's what the gospel does. It changes people's lives. The difference made. The evil confronted, the authority exercised, the difference made. And then, lastly, the service expected. The people in that particular town or city who witnessed the transformation asked Jesus to leave their region. They were frightened by the transformation in this man. In verse 37, isn't that remarkable? They were terrorized by this man. This man terrorized the community. But the powers of hell that were unleashed in his life. But they're more afraid of the power of heaven than they are of the powers of hell. And they ask Jesus to leave their region. And so Jesus leaves. And the man who'd been delivered, understandably, asks in verse 38 to go with Jesus. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged that he might be with him. He wanted to follow Jesus. He wanted to learn from Jesus. He wanted to be in the presence of Jesus, but Jesus refused. Jesus had a job for this man to do. Look at verse 39. "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." And he went away proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. Isn't that interesting? Jesus says, "Go and declare what God has done for you." And he went to the whole city telling them what Jesus had done for him. Jesus, of course, is God. So they were compelling Jesus to leave, but Jesus left this man as a little outpost in this island of hostility to witness to his power and the deliverance that comes through his name. He had to leave, but he left a man to tell how much God had done. And we need to understand that. Those of us that are Christians tonight need to understand that we're saved to serve. We're saved to serve. Not everyone's a preacher. Not everyone's an evangelist, but everybody can do that, can't you? Can you not tell how much Jesus has done for you? How much God has done for you? And people say to you, why do you go to church? Can you not tell them what Jesus has done for you? When people ask why you don't go out and live the kind of life that they live, can you not tell them what Jesus has done for you? When in the tea break you're reading a book, can you not tell them why you're reading that book? Or the Bible, can you not tell them why you're reading the Bible? Could you not pick a book that might be of interest to them and say, and when they inquire and they say, what book are you reading? You say, oh, that's a great book. Would you like to read this book? And pass this book to them. Jesus leaves us to work in the world, to tell what great things God has done for us. Have you spoken to anybody this week about Jesus? Have you? Have you ever spoken to anyone in your life, your Christian life, about Jesus? D.L. Moody said that he made it his intention to have one meaningful conversation with one non-Christian every day. That was the goal he set himself. Well, let's be generous. We'll not talk about one meaningful conversation about a day, but what about a meaningful conversation in the week? By just handing them a book, or somebody who's going through trouble, give them the Joni book. 17-year-old girl is paralyzed in an accident, and let them read that book and follow the story through and be introduced to Jesus. Somebody who's going through hard times and difficult times, get them a book on suffering, how Jesus is the answer. Can you not do that? Could you not speak this week to one person about Jesus and tell them how much God has done for you? I know we're all different. We have different personalities and different temperaments, and some people are just bubbly and are better at doing that than others. But one person this week, give it a go and tell them what great things God has done for you. Jesus had to leave, but he left this man to testify what great things God had done for him. Amen.